Can we have one special presentation to make tonight for our guest speaker tonight, who is celebrating 35 years of recovery? His name is Oli, and I have a chip for him right here. This is Oli. I have a quick little story about Oli, real fast. It's only take like 10 seconds. The first time that I ever got to share at a meeting where I was the chairperson, I was kind of nervous, and Oli was there, and I said, "I don't know what I'm going to say, man. What am I going to do?" And he said, "Just get up there and sling some fucks and be yourself. You can't go wrong, right?" So I'm sure that took care about my language, but that's what he told me. You know what? He said, "Be yourself." And you know what? That's worked very well for me here. And my problem was that I never knew who I was. And I've taken that advice, and it was some of the best advice I've ever gotten. So I'm done. Thank you for letting me be a source.
Hey, I'm Oli, I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank God for restoring me to sanity. There could be some debate on that, possibly. I'd like to sincerely thank my friends who specifically maybe showed up to hear me here, because I don't think I'm that big a deal. But if you drove from your house to come here, I want to thank you. I want to welcome everybody brand new. I say hang on to your ass. It's going to be a hell of a ride, you know. But it sure beats the penitentiary. It's a lot more funner to play in this little pen than it is that pen. You know, I don't have any canned jokes or canned pictures or anything like that. I've avoided doing this for 30 years, being like a speaker. I talk all the time in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings on a subject or a topic or whatever's going on, you know, and I was asked by Bill three times prior to this to do it, and since I'm telling on myself, you know, I weaseled out of it. I'd like to say that on this specific day, you know, not yesterday or tomorrow, at 8 in the morning, my wife dropped me off in front of a recovery home, and then after years told me how glad she was to get rid of me. So that should give you an idea how wonderful I must have been, you know. I'm not necessarily saying that my upbringing made me an alcoholic per se, but I'd like to share a teeny bit about it because I think it sets some ideals and some attitudes and some pressures in for me that later on came to life. You know, I had a friend that shared up here last week, and she was talking about, she was a foreigner. I'm an American now, but I was born in Azores, Portugal. So if I don't speak clearly, it's probably because English is my second language.
Yeah.
You know? Funny how I can do them four-letter words clear as a bell, right, fellas? But I think there were some things that gave me some attitudes later on based on where I was born. You know, I was about 10 years old when I come to this country, but I started out in the beginning, and it's probably something you'd see in some little movie, but I started out in a little island where there was no electricity, no running water, no nothing like that, you know, and I remember it. I remember my father, you know, he gathered up straw and stuff, hustled up some gunny sacks, made a bed out of some driftwood and this and that, and believe it or not, that's what I slept in when I was there. The kerosene lamp and whatever. And the truth is, I think, and later on you'll see the why of it, but you know what, I think that's, once in a great while, you know, it was against the law that he would get a push-up and this and that and catch a pigeon or two in the marketplace in this island. And if you get caught, I guess there's a penalty, but he'd do that. And that would be the only meat I would see on a special, maybe my birthday, maybe. At the age of 7, believe it or not, I would run in the streets hustling to eat, stealing to eat. I didn't choose that. It doesn't make me special, but that's just a fact. You know, I remember vividly knocking on people's doors, begging, and they would give you old, hard, homemade bread. Some of them would have green on it. And I would cut the green off. You'd be amazed when you get extremely hungry what you'll do. And I would cut the green off, pretend one of them was cheese and the other one was bread, and I would eat it and be glad to have it. And that's no baloney. You would think anybody with that kind of start would have surely never went awry as I have. My mother left me, I think I was around the age of 7, came to America. You know, she was born in Tulare. work, and she chopped cotton, did a lot of slave labor back in them times. We're talking quite a few decades ago, to make enough money to bring us here. There was five of us. My father was tied by his waist with a rope, nothing this highfalutin stuff you see today. He would hand drill, you know, in rock by hand, suspended 50, 80 feet down, you know, and put dynamite in the hills before they built the American airport there. This was in the later 50s and very early 60s. You know, and he took a risk like that, even though he wasn't Mr. Perfect, as none of us are, but he took a risk like that to be part of sending his children to this golden land of opportunity. We heard a lot of stories about America, paved gold streets and this and that. And when you come from nothing, everything's really something, man. And I was very shy when I was young, believe it or not. You know, and I ended up coming here. And finally, you know, a couple of 3 years later, left me some aunt. You know, I was out there floundering. I don't really recall if she ever gave a damn or not. All I know is I was on the streets trying to hustle and eat. I climbed like these bandits. I remember big old steps like this giant cathedral. I actually went to school in a castle, a real castle, with real armor. And they would force you to drink castor oil. And, you know, because, you know, that was their treatment. And I used to hate that crap. And it was back when they didn't have this American stuff. They beat you. You know, I mean, they would drag you and then beat you in big old paddles with holes, you know, and kick your ass really good for you. And nobody would do nothing. There was no law against, no fair, none. And that was just the way it was. You know, so that I think sets somewhat of a foundation for some later on some attitudes about monies and stuff. You know, but I ended up coming here and I thought it was going to be wonderful. You know, I couldn't speak English at all or nothing. I was like 9 and a half or so, and then I entered the American school system. Well, they still would spank you in schools here then. And but what happened is my father was a milker because he was uneducated and foreigner and all that. That's the only job he had. A lot of Portuguese people were milkers back then because that's, you know, they were very hard workers but very isolated, and where they were enslaved by the people who owned the dairies. It sounds hokey dokey, but he's like a slave. You did what you told when you were told, and you worked night and day. My father, I remember him, he moaned in aches and pains and get up at 12, go get them cows fleecing to death, you know, and get stuck out in the corrals because the crap was so deep, all by hand and stuff. Get his stuff kicked in and hobbled cows, and it was traumatic for him. Poor old guy, he's passed on, but he was really paid the price. Because he didn't have the luxury of education, driving abilities, and knowing how to maneuver in this land, the golden street land. So he suffered a lot. And it was totally unnecessary for me to suffer because I should have learned better. But I had good intentions when I started. Because I was going to make something of myself. I was the littlest in my family. And I was going to be a somebody here in America. But I started going to grammar schools, and I didn't speak. And my father was, you know, was like a migrant worker. 1 month I'd be here, and this guy here is in Portuguese, he knows. And another month he'd be in some other area. It was Turlock, Newman, Hilmar, and different from Modesto, Merced. And, you know, he's always forever picking up stakes and going, because that's what he had to do. You'd get canned, you'd get terminated, whatever, until you get out of here. And he was trying to survive. So he went wherever the work was offered. And so even though I had that language barrier, I was switching schools. And, you know, I don't know, some of you guys, even though those who were born, your kids were very mean. They make fun of you and shun you and stick you to the corner, whisper about you and things of that nature. And because I didn't have the ability to understand what was going on, I got blamed for everything that was dirty or whatever. You know, if somebody rode on the fence, it was my fault. You know, the greenhorn, the Portuguese kid. And I got called worse things, believe it or not, when I didn't deserve them. I got called things later on I didn't deserve. I'll get to that. You know? So it kind of went, and I still had a lot of ambitions. I was going to make my mark here in America and be somebody, man. You know, and I had dreams. I thought I might be a millionaire with some of the stories and things I heard. And I thought, I could do it. So I worked real hard learning English and all that kind of stuff. And then I just kept moving around. And it got really, really frustrating after a lot of moves. Always a new school, stuck out like a sore thumb. Kids would have nice little lunch pails, and I'd have leftovers in a rainbow sack. Very embarrassing. I didn't know any better. So I got all chastised a lot. Believe it or not, when you chastise a lot, sometimes you get a little attitude. I got a little attitude. But I kept on and kept on and kept on, and finally I never felt like I fit. I was kind of like introverted a little bit, and I wasn't outspoken like I am today or nothing. And I just kept hanging on to this dream of mine. And finally, I remember, by the time I got to Tulare and Tulare Western, I met the crowd, you know, because I was kind of off to the side kind of thing. I'd had some broken English and an accent, but I met the crowd. And you know, when I met the kind of the crowd and had a few, you know, for the first time ever, I felt accepted. I was able to talk to them little girls that sent me notes. They see anything, excuse me, would put notes in my locker and, you know, little junior high school kind of stuff. But I was too scared to answer them notes. I didn't know how to answer the notes, so I never did. But when I got to Western, I drank a little bit with the fellas. Man, I became a little lady killer almost instantly. I'm telling you, when I drank, I became verbal. I became bigger, more muscular, and more able. And I thought, right on, man. I'm talking to the boys, I'm talking to the chicks, I'm feeling good. It was in the 60s when doing a hippie thing. And I tried the hippie thing. It was all the free love you wanted for free. There was no STDs. It was good and free. Two men, two now. If your sign's right, we'll get naked. I go, I love America. I'm drinking, I'm cool, I'm accepted, I'm getting laid, I love it. And it was good for quite a while. You know, I worked. I didn't drink every day at all. I went, and not there was a drinking problem, I went to bars, honky-tonk bars and various kinds of bars in Tulare. Down K Street was like 22 of them. And I hung out with my friends. It was live music, piano bars. I made associates. I made friends with some of them people, you know. And it was good, man. I was having a lot of fun. Well, my wife wasn't much then. Of course, I lied about it. We just separated. Because I was already on the road to being a dog. But not really, really. I can see that today, but I'm thinking, I'm just an American. Turn on the TV, it's Bud Olympia and Hams and Sky Blue Waters. Remember that guy? And all that, and it was attractive, and there was long, sleek, beautiful women in the telly with long-stemmed glasses. And they would be next to a guy in a tux sipping on that wine. And I'm thinking, yeah, America. That's for me. That's for me, man. What is wrong with dancing and having a few? I mean, I'm my friends. I work all week. I work. I save my, I do my money and stuff. I start a couple, three little bit. I mean, what? So I go out on the weekend, have a few drinks. What's the big deal, I thought? Not hurting nobody, right? I come home all the time. Well, almost. I started faltering more and more towards the end. You know? And it worked for me. Alcohol at the time worked for me. I was able to indoctrinate myself and mash myself with what's happening. You know what I mean? Then I started, and my fault, of course. But it was even when things were cheap. I got my first drunk driving home. I didn't understand it. You know? Got a drunk driving. I'm thinking, how come they don't get real criminals and stuff? Here I am just out of the bar minding my own business. I ain't doing nothing bad. It's not like I'm some crazy or something doing something. Why mess with me? But I told myself, I'll be the last effing time that you bust me for drunk driving. You know, that's it, buddy. And you know, and I don't know why I was so pissed. My mother paid for it. It was $305. No probation, no nothing. But I was angry because they got me for drunk driving. I don't deserve it. And I did good. I did good. About a year, man. I was still drinking. I was driving. I was going to doing a do. And then New Year's Eve, I'll be a damn. And I didn't quite understand it. I'm watching the speedometer. I'm watching the rearview mirror. I know they're out there. I'm making sure I didn't swerve. Prior to getting in the car, I gave myself the drunk test. I held one foot up. I go, surely, I can't be drunk. I still stand on one foot. I'm not drunk. As a matter of fact, you're going to think this is a little insane, but I thought I drove better drunk. I don't know if there's anybody in there like that. I'm a better driver than when I'm buzzing. I got that second drunk driver. You know, they get a little tougher on you, number two. To cut to the chase, it became three, became four. And this is terrible. You know what I did? I was drinking and not paying attention to what time of day it is because I was up at town with the fellas hanging out, hot rods and screaming at the babes and, you know, doing all my flexing, jerking people out of cars because I'm badass now, you know. And this poor guy, he needed to stay up, and I wasn't, drugs weren't particularly my forte, but I just happened to have a dime bag, which is not a lot of money, $10, of little cross tops. That was the end thing then. And I had them just in case, because I drive drinking, and I figured, if I do a few of these, I'll be alert, I won't pass out, and I won't get a drunk driver. It made perfect sense. What I do is I'll have them as a backup. And if I start getting felony stupid, I'll take four or five of these, drive my ass on home, and everything be cool. Right? So this one guy needed him worse than me. We were up at Jack in the Box, of all places, and Tulare. And he showed an interest in him. And I'm thinking, well, I'm running out of money. I got a good buzz going. I sure hate to quit now. So I thought, screw it. $10. You can buy a couple, three, six-packs for $10. So I handed him these dime bags. I barely remember it. And because he was a good convincer, I think. I wasn't hard to influence, I don't think. And to finish my drunk, well, needless to say, later on, when they got their stuff together, me and over 200 other people got busted in a raid. They busted good, old-hearted Ovi for selling drugs to an undercover cop. I'm thinking, talk about injustice. But you know what? Because I have blackouts and I don't always on top of my game when I drink, I go, I didn't do this. I'm not a drug addict. I just booze it up. Well, I took a little LSD because it was the era. You know, you got to do a little there with your friends, right? And the music's going on and the colors on the wall and the videos. I don't know if you've lived through that era, some of you older guys. And the babes are there and they're hippie-like stuff. And they got orange wedge and all this other kind of LSD stuff. And it's the stuff. So I have to try it a few times just to make sure that I can handle it. More than once, right? It says more than once to make sure that, you know. And then, you know what? I thought I found the perfect solution to LSD. Because, you know, LSD, some people were jumping out their windows, killing themselves. And I go, well, that don't look very good to me. Jumping out the window under an acid trip is not exactly the way I want to end up this joyous occasion. So, yes, I found a solution. Like you said, I found mescaline. You get all the same high, but you don't flip out. It was wonderful. Mescaline was the ticket. I did that for a while. That could explain some of the brain damage that I've been talking about. You know? You would think, I don't know about the users out there, you would think that a person would start getting a clue after four drunk driving and all of the stuff I've just talked about, that there's possibly something wrong with me. I'm going to tell you, not, no, no, no. Them effing cops, man, if you live with that woman I live with, you drink too. Cheat on her. She don't cooperate. It's not my fault. Besides, this is a long time ago. Besides, what am I hurting? What she don't know won't hurt her. I just come home, bathe, and be good. Treat her right. What has she got to be mad about? I have that kind of thinking. It's silly today. I'm making a point to say it because I see how insane, how stupid it is today. But at the time, I didn't think so. You know that nobody ever offered me any kind of treatment in all them times I went to court. I thought of myself as a great intelligent manipulator. You know most of them drunk drive-ins I beat on technicalities. And I thought, whoa. I ended up in this recovery home. And so I petitioned the court and this and that and ended up getting a court order there already. I took my license for 3 years. But I'm kind of tenacious. That might have helped me here a little bit. And so I petitioned the court and I got two priors struck. And DMV had one and had to give me back my license because there was no cost to remove them. It was based on priors. And the priors were unconstitutional, so therefore no reason to take them, right? But they wouldn't do it. I thought, hey, I'll have none of this. I did like my friend. I put my butt up there in front of that judge. I said, Your Honor, you remember that order and that constitution and priors that you deemed unconstitutional, you know, you struck? Yeah? He goes, well, I went to DMV and asked them to get my license back. They refused to follow your order. You know what happened, right? He made a new order. And he made him give him my license back. In the recovery home, I was the hero. Everybody wanted me to get their license back. I had a moment of glory in the recovery home. You know, I went to that recovery home, you would think it's because I savvied up, my life was a wreck, and I knew that I was in trouble. Because I became aware that my life was devastated, and I was living an immoral, illegal life. You would think that I have enough sense to see that prior to going to try to get some kind of form of treatment. But that's not true. That recovery home because I heard through the grapevine. I thought it was like Road Camp. I didn't even know what it was. I'd never been to a detox or recovery home, nothing all my life. And I went there because I heard it was kind of a way out. You know what I mean? Rather than jail. And I know a lot about jail. I did geographics and stuff, and within 24 hours when I did a geographic, I was back in California. I was already busted for another drunk driving in front of a bar going to jail. And a guy who thought I was the best thing since popcorn wouldn't shut up. They took him to jail because he thought I was nifty and he wasn't going to have it. So they put me and him both in the same cell. Well, at least we went in on a buddy plan. That's a good thing, right? So I'm in this recovery home, and I'm brain dead, but I don't know it. It's like sometimes, you know, like pregnancy. Sometimes the husband's the last guy to know it, right? And so I'm unaware of my situation because I'm busy being hip, slick, and cool. Because after all, I'm a hero. I can make the judge put him in check. You know, and that's kind of how it went. Charlene used to snicker. I'd come with some long line of bull, and she'd go, just like that. I hated her. She had this rouge kind of lipstick, looked like a hooker. I'm saying she was a great human being. Really devoted for women and women's stuff. She was starting stuff for women when it was unheard of. All of that. But I had character defects that I was unaware of at the time. And also I judged her. I judged her as many of us do on her outside appearance, rather than have the ability to be open-minded and be a good listener, because I was too full of my damn self, thinking I'm better than, smarter than, to listen to your horse shit. Big mistake I made. But I hung in there, playing the game, telling these guys, oh, I need it, this and that. It was a big facade, but they let me in, because I wanted a court off my butt. You know what I mean? And I just ran game. I ran game and talked a lot of smack, and I went to them damn groups and resisted it and everything. But I made it through there. But about the fourth, fifth month, I started acquiring. I started coming to a teeny bit, and I heard a lot of good stuff from Frank Ross, who God bless his soul, passed on. He was my sponsor for 30 years. And I go to them thing, and he was really a great influence on me. He was a guy that knew tons of everything about alcohol. Those who knew Frank know exactly where I'm coming from. But he didn't have airs about your attire, your grammar, or any of that. He was interested in language of the heart, some honesty, some integrity. He never busted my chops for saying four-letter words like I was immoral, vulgar, or anything else. He understood. He understood. He wasn't so shallow. He could see the man underneath. He was a wise old man. And he loved me. He gave me an example of what to be like, even when I didn't recognize it fully and I didn't know I could do it. But he impressed me. Sometimes it only takes one person. So I hooked me up a little job at Pine. And I had my first job, and I find this humorous today. I went through a CETA program, like a self-help kind of thing way back then, and they pay half your wages. And so Frank gave me a shot of working there because, you know, he's going to give me for half price, right? He knows a good deal. And so I started to do that. And my first title, it took me weeks to memorize it. Check this out, man, and I was really impressed with it. I was an occupational opportunity developer. Boy, ain't that deep, huh? For a moron, that's a hell of a title, ain't it? I pressed my little ass around there. Yeah, I'm an opportunity developer. Guys would come in. You know basically what I did? Like it took a lot of brains. I filled out some welfare papers and walked them to the welfare and back. Yeah, I'm a hero in this home. But it was a big deal then. And I completed that, and I guess somewhat I must have had a little something going. Good old Frank gave me a permanent job with full pay there. And I don't know if he did it on purpose or not, but we had a sober station. And back then, he was the first recovery home ever, and I didn't know it for 20 years, but he didn't tell me for 20 years, but he went to Washington, him and Shirlene to get licensed. It was a creative new idea, and he put me down as a detox coordinator when he went to Washington to get an approval. I didn't know it. He kept that to himself and gave me the paperwork 20-some years later. Probably thought my head couldn't handle it at the time. When they put me in his detox, I thought, detox coordinator. Oh, I love titles. I was the man. I didn't know when he, you know, because he just called me up and said, hey, you're the detox coordinator. And I thought, boy, you're going to say no to him? I just gave me a job. I'm doing a thing, and I can't say no to a detox coordinator. Frank said so. I respected Frank. You know, how many of you guys been in this social model detoxes? A lot? You know what they do, right? They watch you all the time, choke and puke and gag and try to talk all this warm and fuzzy shit to you, make you drink stupid shit you don't want to drink. You know, stuff like that. Watch you around the clock. See, that's what I did. My job was to help people shower, hand feed them, talk to them when they're in delirium tremors, do seizures when they flopped on the floor, run down to Quia Delta and try to get them admitted when they have severe tremors and totally out of it. And then Quia Delta at the time, it wasn't illegal, they turned them away and I had to take them back. I mean, serious people. Because the drugs were unpredictable, and the meds they gave them, the things they tried to treat them with, I'm talking 4 decades ago. They didn't know how to treat. They would give them something sedate and they'd go berserk. They got frustrated. And Frank had a concoction put together called Kickapoo juice. You had to drink a gallon of that when you came to detox. I don't know all the ingredients, but I made everybody drink it because Frank said so. Frank said so. You can't say no to Frank. It's like saying no to Abraham Lincoln. You know? So I worked at this place for 3.5 years. I'd say the name of it, but I want any of you guys to go, because I don't like that. Okay? But I want to tell you that I'm the old school, the real alumni from the day. And that's the truth, so help me God, 1979. I never planned on staying at all. I'm going to get the people off my ass, manipulate the judge, and you can kiss it. That's exactly how I felt at the time. I'm role-playing because I'm a comedian. I go into Cowboy Inn. Within a week or so, I'm a cowboy. I go to biker stocks when I'm drinking. I'm a 1% of a little bit, and I'm a badass. I do all the crazy stuff because I'm little. I got a big mouth, and I got to put it on the front line because I need respect from the bros, and they're twice my size. And if I don't hold, my mother will beat me to death and kick me out of a car like they did a bunch of other sissies. So I'm living the life. But when I got sober, I didn't feel so 1%er anymore. And, you know, I kind of was more hesitant to hang out with the bros riding in badass Harley. I did, but I didn't have all that gusto like when I was drinking. When I was drinking, I'd take anybody on kind of a thing. I built up a nice little rep for myself. And I thought I was at the top of the food chain. Even the big guys, they're not clowning me. They're having their little proteges push my back out. Kids started warming up for me because I got respect. Nobody messes with me. Nobody. And I thought, man, I've arrived. Yeah, I'm not 6'4", but I'll clean your clock in a tenth of a second. Because then, at that time, I didn't care about dying. I knew I was going to die before I was 30, and I accepted it. I was okay with it. I knew that jails and death was coming. But I was having a hell of a good time. And I figured, you know what, I'm going to do more than most people in this 30 years, than people, than clowns do, than four squares in 60. If I go early, so what? I've had a good life. I got hookers. I got all kinds of stuff going on. I'm making more money by accident. Most of these clowns are working all week. And I'm going, what? What? I got all the women. I'm setting up all my friends with women from here to the coast for free. Because that was my little forte. I don't know. I think they call that prostitution or something like that. I don't know. And I'm thinking, yeah, baby, everybody called me for chicks. And the guys would call me to go ride. And man, for a little guy, like Portuguese guy that was insecure, immature, and scared to death, man, that's at the top of the hill, I thought. Top of the hill. So I came to AA and I hung around. I was just getting on. And what happened is I hung around a bit. You would think that I'd come to and say, I think I'll work these steps. I didn't. I parked my dumb butt in a meeting, took everybody's inventory, because they tell you to take inventory, right? I don't think I heard that right. I took all your inventories all the time. I was sitting in the meetings while they're talking about God and higher powers and all that warm and fuzzy stuff, and I think, look at that bitch. And I'm wondering, how come I don't feel good? Because other people are talking this wonderful God healings and happiness, and I'm inside, because I got too much ego and false pride to say anything. I'm thinking, phony bunch of some bitch. And then the guys would walk across the floor. I'm talking about my initial, after the planking a little bit. And guys walk across the floor, and I'm, I don't know about you, but I'm sizing them up. I'm in AA, I already got three, 4, 5 months, 6, something like that. And I'm sizing them up. I said, hey, you're no way. You're messing with me, and I'll rock your stuff. I'll show you that I'm little, but I can rock and roll. Because I've had some formal training in this and that. And I'll show you that I'm not all about this. I'm thinking to myself, I'll put you in a hospital. How you like that? And then I go, gee. And then the thoughts went on in my mind all the time. And I'm thinking, how come I don't feel good? And then, you know what? They confused me. They come here, and you newcomers, well, you probably hear this a lot. They go, well, easy does it. Well, it's a selfish program. And I thought, man, I found my place. I've been selfish all my life. They're giving me the green light to be selfish here. Got a lot of chicks. I like it. I got a new honey. And I got babes. I got money. I got status. I've arrived in AA. It's silly, the kind of things we think. I wasn't drinking and drugging. My mind was still gone. But you know what? I didn't have full awareness. My mind was gone. I thought it never left me. Why is it gone? Where'd it go? You know what I mean? So I resisted and I resisted. I resisted. And what happened, like maybe some of you might happen, one day, unbeknownst to me, not that I chose it, one day, the emotional crisis happened subconsciously and in my emotions that I could no longer stay in that meeting one more second. And I didn't plan this. I didn't do nothing special for it or nothing. And it came time to get the hell in or get the hell out. And through the grace of God, and I emphasize that, I got in. And I plundered and trudged and, you know, it was be good, be naughty, be good, be naughty. And I went back and forth and worked at it and worked at it and worked at it and worked at it and worked at it. You know, and I'm not levitating, but I'm not the vengeful, angry kind of person I used to be. I'm not perfect, but I don't use that as a cop-out to continue that behavior. I try to behave right. I'm old. I'll tell you what. I'm going to tell you, if I talked in AA for 100 years, and I mean this, I would never pay back what you people and what you've done for me, an unworthy, unwilling, undeserving guy like me. I found a home here. After I surrendered, I was able to recreate a whole brand new Oldie. I told my sponsor once, I go, I want to go by my real name. And then I tried it, and people wouldn't call me by my real name. They kept calling me by Oldie. And I got real frustrated. I went to Frank. I said, Frank, man, I want to go by my real name. It's good enough for my father. It should be good enough for me. And I told him, these people are harassing me. They wouldn't call me by my real name. And he looked at me because, and then I wish he had a video of this guy. These guys are this stuff. And he said, well, you know what, Ollie? Why don't you just build a whole new person around that old name? So I've been working on that a long time. I wish I could say that I levitate and I'm perfect every day and every single little thought's pure and that I never get angry and nobody ever upsets me. You can't move my emotions, but that's not true. You know, it says that sometimes with people that don't mix, and I think that's true. I think a lot of people in a room are not here for the same reason that I stayed, or the reason I'm here. And sometimes they'll cause havoc in your life. They're devious, conniving, manipulative, and they'll do mean things. And sometimes put you in a position of uncomfortability where you may be forced to retaliate a little bit by saying, get away from me, man. It wasn't that long ago when I had to holler at a guy. Not that I wanted to do anything to him. He wouldn't move away from me. I asked him politely twice. He wouldn't do it. Man, I think I got an example to be and a responsibility. I'm going, I don't really want to holler at this guy. This is what I used to do all the time, right? But he wouldn't do it. I finally had to get up in his grill and holler. I didn't threaten or hit him, but I had to get real nasty with him. And it took a couple of escalating. I think my sponsee was there. He's right over there in that blue shirt. I had to really get aggressive with this guy to get him away from me. And I felt, I go, why should that be necessary? Before I called, I was getting the kid from a, that, you know what, I was at a meeting just a day ago, something, right? I was at a meeting, minding my own business, doing what everybody does. No big deal, just say a little kind this and that like Nora, everybody does, you know. And I had this guy that has a little resentment, and he likes to, because he had this resentment against me, he won't come and talk to me like we're supposed to. It's been a month. And so the way he likes to do it, and he likes to front me off in a group, correct me, tell me to be quiet, put me in check while everybody's listening. So he's a little bit grandiose. He wants to make sure that I behave the way he thinks I should, when he says it, how he says it. Because after all, he has the right to tell me what to do. And he had done it twice before, and I did the love and tolerance, right? Because I'm not here to fight anybody, right? So I did the love and tolerance. I thought, okay, well, the first time, second time, maybe he's just forgot the first time. So I'm at the meeting, Nora's up there, and this Gia, she's celebrating her 12th birthday. I'm whispering to an Indian girl that's new, and I'm over there, but he sees my face turn. I was alcoholic and drunk, I was 22 years, man. I've been around here 35. I don't know everything, but trust me, I know something. So he sees my face turn, he took that opportunity while he's reading a little pamphlet, and she was there, to call me out in front of everybody again. Stops his reading in front of my family, calls me out, this knucklehead. By now it's time three. So I go, hey, am I bothering you? A lot better than what I would have said 15 years ago. Believe me. My sons are in the room, they could probably tell you, I've been sober most of my sons' lives, but it took a while to try to rekindle a relationship because once upon a time I was ornery and mean. One of my biggest regrets. So I thought about this guy. I go, well, this guy don't have good sense to leave me alone. It was very embarrassing. You know, I didn't like it. You know, it was very uncomfortable. I come there to celebrate with a friend, and now I'm in a corner because of some knucklehead's resentment. I don't have enough guts to come and talk to me. So now I'm in a position, a kind of a dilemma. You know what I mean? So during the break, 5 minutes, and I apologized to Nora a little bit earlier, you know, I lean on the table and look at him. I said, hey, you need to knock that off. He goes, excuse me, I'm talking. he's a really little drama queen, like I don't know what time of day it is. I go, hey, you need to knock it off. He goes, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? Like, oh yeah, okay, I got it. And I go, you know what I'm talking about, so do I. Knock it off. So I'm hoping he got the message. I didn't hit him. I didn't threaten him. I didn't choke him. I think I did pretty good. But I'm not perfect. Thank you.